You walk into a massive, bustling hospital, right? The lights are humming, the life-saving monitors are blinking, the air conditioning is perfectly chilled.
Yeah, or, I mean, even if you're just sitting in your favorite coffee shop plugging your laptop into the wall.
Exactly. You probably don't even think twice about it. You just expect the power to be there. But behind a locked metal door, somewhere in every single one of these buildings, there is a literal beast of raw, dangerous electrical energy.
Oh, absolutely. And it has to be flawlessly tamed before it ever reaches your screen. Because, well, the challenge isn't just generating that electricity. The real engineering marvel is stepping down the absolute violence of the raw utility grid so it can safely power a delicate monitor.
Right, without blowing the building off the map.
Without blowing off the map, exactly. If the infrastructure managing that massive influx of power isn't precisely matched to the physics of the building, the consequences are catastrophic. We aren't talking about a blown fuse here. We are talking about explosive structural damage.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because today's deep dive is taking us straight into that locked mechanical room. We are looking at a highly detailed technical guide that compares three crucial pieces of electrical infrastructure. Switchgear, switchboards, and panel boards.
Right.
Now, I know what you might be thinking. You're thinking, this sounds like an engineering textbook. But I promise you, this is actually about the invisible architecture of modern life. Our mission today is to decode these three identical-looking gray metal boxes.
Yeah, and reveal the hidden hierarchy that dictates the safety, the cost, and, well, the maintenance of literally every building you walk into.
Exactly. Because these three terms, right, switchgear, switchboard, panel board, they're tossed around almost interchangeably by people outside the electrical trade.
And sadly, sometimes even by people inside it. Understanding the strict boundaries between them is really the ultimate shortcut to understanding how massive amounts of dangerous energy are safely distributed for our everyday use.
I want to make sure that by the end of this deep dive, you will never look at a mechanical room or, you know, even just the breaker box in your hallway the same way again. So let's start with the root of the confusion. The sources mention something called the blueprint illusion. What is that?
Right. So what's fascinating here is how a two-dimensional engineering drawing completely strips away the physical context of the equipment.
Okay.
I mean, on paper, all three of these systems just look like a generic box with lines coming out of it. And at their most basic anatomical level, they share the exact same DNA.
Right. They're all just metal boxes.
Yeah. They're all metal enclosed assemblies. They all contain bus bars, protective devices, and field wiring terminations.
Okay, wait. Let's define some of those terms for the listener. Because field wiring terminations and bus bars, that sounds a little intimidating.
So a bus bar is essentially a massive, thick strip of solid copper or aluminum. When you are dealing with thousands of amps of electricity, standard wire would just melt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so engineers use these solid metal bars to conduct the heavy current inside the enclosure.
Got it. And protective devices.
Those are your breakers or fuses, you know, the safety gates that trip when something goes wrong. And field wiring terminations are simply the physical metal lugs where the electrician connects the building's wires to the actual box.
So because they share those same basic internal parts, vendor catalogs and documentation get lazy.
Extremely lazy. They start calling everything a distribution board or like main service equipment without being specific.
Right. But I imagine a lazy label in a catalog isn't harmless in the real world.
No, not at all. Code enforcement does not treat these as casual synonyms. The National Electrical Code, specifically NEC Article 408, aggressively separates the rules for switchboards and switchgear from the provisions for panel boards.
The rules are completely different.
Completely. The construction differs, the access requirements differ, and obviously the intended use differs.
So what happens if someone in the real world mixes them up? Say an engineer specifies a panel board when they really meant a switchboard. What's the danger there?
Well, it creates terrifying assumptions for the electrician working on it. A bad label creates the wrong access expectation.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the worker might assume they can safely open a panel while it's energized, not realizing they are staring down a piece of equipment designed to handle a much higher threshold of explosive energy.
That is terrifying.
It is. And this legal boundary is universal. The U.S. relies on NEC Article 408 alongside strict testing standards from underwriters laboratories like UL 1558, UL 891, and UL 67.
And internationally?
The international community relies on the IEC 61439 standard to provide that exact same rigid framework.
Okay, so since the engineering code treats these three systems as a strict hierarchy of power, I think the best way to understand them is to physically trace the electricity. Let's start our exploration at the very end of the line, the equipment you're probably sitting closest to right now, and work our way upstream toward the massive utility grid.
Sounds good.
Talk to me about the downstream workhorse, the panel board.
Right. So the panel board is the absolute standard for downstream branch circuit distribution. When we say branch circuits, we're talking about the final delivery of power to the end loads.
So this is the electricity powering your ceiling lighting.
Exactly. Your ceiling lighting, your wall receptacles, and the smaller mechanical loads like the fan in your HVAC system.
I'm picturing the gray metal door set into the wall in like a long apartment corridor.
Yeah.
Is that design intentional?
Highly intentional. The governing standard here in the U.S. is UL 67. And a defining characteristic of a commercial panel board is that it's designed to be placed in a cabinet directly against a wall or entirely recessed inside the wall.
And you can only open it from the front.
Right. Accessible only from the front. The engineering goal here is to be unobtrusive. Commercial real estate is incredibly expensive, right? So panel boards are optimized for limited space areas like tight corridors and small tenant electrical closets.
And because they are at the end of the line, they handle lower amounts of power. The sources say they typically max out at a 1200 amp incoming main.
Correct.
But I have to admit, I'm a little confused by some of the terminology in the guide here. Because I've been to the hardware store to look at a box for my garage, and the signs in the aisle all say load centers.
Oh, yeah.
Does the NEC treat a load center differently than a panel board?
That is a major misconception. Legally and technically, as far as the safety testing laboratories and the NEC are concerned, there is no formal code level difference between a panel board and a load center.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Load center is simply a marketing term.
Literally just a marketing term.
Just marketing. Decades ago, manufacturers needed a way to sell smaller, lower-cost plug-on panel boards to the residential market. They coined load center and make it sound, you know, user-friendly.
Oh, wow.
But if you are working on a commercial engineering specification, panel board remains the correct term.
Okay, so the wall-mounted panel board handles the local branches. But if a panel board physically maxes out at 1,200 amps, it obviously cannot handle the massive influx of raw utility power required for an entire commercial skyscraper.
No, definitely not.
To manage that kind of load, we have to step away from the wall. We have to look at the freestanding heavyweights.
Which brings us to the middleweight champion of the hierarchy, the switchboard.
I'm looking at the power jump here, and it's staggering.
Uh-huh.
We go from a 1,200 amp limit in panel boards up to a 6,000 amp main bus in switchboards.
Yeah, it's a massive leap. Switchboards occupy the crucial middle tier of distribution, governed largely by the UL 891 standard. These are no longer cabinets bolted to a wall.
Right.
A switchboard is a massive freestanding structural frame, or, you know, multiple frames bolted together. In many mid-sized commercial facilities like office parks, hotels, or large retail centers, the switchboard is the very first piece of equipment that receives power directly from the outside utility grid.
Because it acts as that main gateway, I assume it needs completely different physical features than the panel board in my hallway.
Absolutely. One critical feature you will find in a switchboard is a CT metering compartment.
Okay, CT metering.
Yeah, CT stands for current transformer. When you are dealing with thousands of amps from the utility, you can't just run that massive current through a standard electricity meter to calculate the bill.
It would just melt, right?
The meter would completely explode.
Ah, so the current transformer steps that massive river of electricity down to a tiny trickle just for the purpose of measuring it.
Exactly. It scales the measurement safely so the utility knows exactly how much power to bill the building for.
Makes sense.
Switchboards also change how electricians physically interact with the equipment. Unlike a panel board, UL standards explicitly note that switchboards may be constructed to allow access from the rear as well as the front.
So what does this all mean? We have massive capacity and freestanding frames. But if a switchboard is so much more powerful than a panel board, how do the breakers inside it physically work? Are they just giant versions of the switches in my house?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the entire engineering philosophy of a switchboard is about balancing massive capacity with practical economy.
Okay.
It handles heavy lifting cost effectively. And to keep costs down, switchboards predominantly rely on fixed breakers.
Fixed breakers.
Right. These are molded case or insulated case breakers that are permanently bolted directly onto those thick copper bus bars we talked about earlier.
Wait, if they are permanently bolted to the main copper bars carrying thousands of amps, how does an electrician safely fix one if it breaks?
They don't. At least not while the power is on.
Seriously?
Yeah, the economy at the switchboard comes at the heavy cost of isolation. Because the breakers are bolted in, servicing them usually means the electrician has to de-energize the main bus.
So to fix one breaker for a single floor, you have to shut off the power to a massive section of the entire building.
Frequently, yes. You have to kill the power to ensure the electrician doesn't get electrocuted while unbolting the component.
Which naturally forces an incredible engineering dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you are powering a facility, like a hospital or a data center, processing millions of financial transactions, where shutting down broad sections of power for routine maintenance isn't just an inconvenience, but an absolute crisis?
Right.
I mean, if I'm a patient in an ICU, my life support monitor cannot go dark just because an electrician needs to change a breaker down the hall.
And that dilemma is the exact reason the industry created the absolute highest specification level in low voltage distribution, the heavyweight. Switchgear.
I'm looking at the engineering standards, specifically IEEE C37.20.1 and UL1158. This is the top of the mountain. It can handle up to a 10,000 amp main bus.
It's a beast.
But reading through our sources, it seems the defining architectural feature of switchgear isn't actually its raw size, it's compartmentalization, and specifically something called dry-out power breakers.
Yes.
Walk me through this, because I want to understand how it mechanically solves the ICU problem.
Well, this raises an important question about the true value of continuity in mission-critical environments. In a switchboard, components share open space and are bolted down, but in switchgear, every individual power circuit breaker is housed in its own heavily shielded separate metal compartment.
Okay.
And instead of being bolted to the bus bars, the breakers are drawout.
How does a drawout breaker physically operate?
Think of it like a heavy-duty drawer on sliding tracks. A true drawout mechanism physically moves through four distinct mechanical stages, connected, test, disconnected, and removed.
Walk me through those four stages. What is happening inside the metal box?
So when the breaker is in the connected position, it's fully engaged. Massive metal prongs on the back of the breaker are gripping the live copper bus bars, and power is flowing normally.
Right.
Now, say an engineer needs to perform maintenance. Instead of shutting down the whole building, they insert a crank into the front of the gear and physically rack the breaker forward along its tracks into the test position.
Does rolling it forward unplug it from the main power?
Yes. The physical movement disconnects those massive main power contacts from the live bus bars. The dangerous high voltage is completely severed. But here is the genius part. The secondary control wiring, the tiny wires that talk to the diagnostic computers and safety relays, that stays plugged in.
Oh, that is brilliant. So they can test the mechanical operation, trigger the safety trips, and run diagnostics without the raw utility power flowing through it.
Precisely. From there, they can rack it further out to the disconnected position, where even the control wiring is severed. But the heavy breaker is still physically supported inside its metal cell.
Okay.
And finally, in the removed position, they use a specialized lift to pull the breaker completely out of the lineup. They can slide a spare breaker right back in its place in minutes.
And the rest of the hospital never even sees the lights flicker.
Exactly. It provides perfectly clean isolation.
The compartmentalization must also play a role in safety, beyond just maintenance. The sources dedicate a lot of time to arc flash containment.
Oh, yeah. That's huge.
For the listener who hasn't heard that term, an arc flash is a terrifying explosion of electrical energy. It's what happens when a massive fault jumps through the air, turning the air itself into plasma.
Yeah, an arc flash is one of the most violent events that can happen in a building. The intense heat can vaporize solid metal instantly. In a standard switchboard with open construction, that plasma can travel down the bus bars and consume the entire massive cabinet. Switchgear is fundamentally different.
Because every breaker is in its own metal vault.
Yes. The heavy compartmentalization physically chokes the explosion. In fact, switchgear offers highly tested arc-resistant options under the IEC 37.2.7 standard.
Wow.
The metal walls and specialized exhaust flaps are designed to direct the explosive energy up and out the top of the building, away from the worker standing in front of it.
So you are paying a premium, not just for the extra copper and metal, but for the maintainability and the survival of the facility.
Exactly.
So now that the distinct identities of all three assemblies are clear, the wall-mounted panel board, the economical switchboard, and the compartmentalized switchgear, how does an engineer actually navigate this hierarchy to make a choice?
Yeah.
Because looking at the selection guide, it turns out you don't just pick the one you like. The physical reality of the grid actually makes the choice for you.
It is a rigid, non-negotiable order of operations. Mm-hmm. The guide outlines a 5-question selection gauntlet.
Okay, lay it on me.
Number 1, available fault current. Number 2, current rating. Number 3, maintenance needs. Number 4, room geometry. And only at the very end, number 5, budget.
Here's where it gets really interesting. You would think budget is the absolute first thing a commercial developer looks at.
Right, you'd think so.
But this available fault current acts as a bouncer at the door, strictly dictating what equipment is legally allowed in the mechanical room before money is even discussed. What physically is available fault current?
Well, to understand a fault current, imagine a massive hydroelectric dam holding back a colossal lake of water. That lake is the utility grid.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Under normal conditions, you only open the valves a tiny bit to let water flow to your sinks and showers. That is your normal operating current.
But a fault is like a catastrophic pipe burst.
Exactly. If a massive main pipe bursts right next to the dam, the entire weight of that lake will try to violently blast through the hole at once. That is the available fault current. It's the maximum amount of catastrophic energy the utility grid can potentially dump into a short circuit at the exact point where the equipment is installed.
Okay, and our sources highlight that this fault current is highest the closer you are to the utility source. But as the power travels deeper into the building, it slows down due to something called impedance. How does physical wire act as a bottleneck?
Continuing the water metaphor, impedance is the physical friction inside the pipes. Even the best copper wire has a tiny amount of electrical resistance. So if the pipe bursts 3 miles away from the dam, the water has to fight its way through miles of narrow winding plumbing first. The friction of the long pipe physically restricts how much water can rush out of the hole.
So the further into the building the electricity travels, the more the physical wire chokes the potential explosion.
Yes. That is why the engineer must recalculate the fault current at every step downstream. So let's look at the math of that invisible bouncer.
All right.
If the available fault current at the installation point is choked down to under 10 kiloamperes, which means 10,000 amps of explosive potential, a standard panel board is perfectly acceptable. It can safely withstand that hit.
And if the math says the burst pipe would release between 10 and 35 kiloamperes, the bouncer says you can use a high-rated panel board or a standard switchboard.
Right. Now, if the potential energy jumps to between 35 and 100 kiloamperes, the switchboard becomes the safest default. And if you're dealing with a massive service entrance where the fault current is above 100 kiloamperes,
the bouncer turns everything else away. Switchgear is universally required. It doesn't matter if the switchgear costs 10 times more. If the fault current is that high, a panel board or a switchboard would literally vaporize in the event of a severe short circuit.
Which emphasizes exactly why an engineer of record must run a meticulous short circuit study. The source material warns that while an arc flash analysis is vital for predicting how much protective clothing a worker needs, it does not replace the raw fault current calculation used for equipment selection.
Right.
Understanding the physics of that invisible reservoir is the absolute foundation of electrical safety in any structure.
And this brings it all right back to you, the listener. Whether you are sitting in a tiny studio apartment, working in a glass high-rise office, or visiting a patient in a hospital room, your physical safety in that building is actively being maintained by an engineer who painstakingly solved this exact 5-question gauntlet years before you ever walked through the doors.
Yeah, they analyzed the immense pressure of the grid, they calculated the friction of the wires, they planned for maintenance access, they measured the room layout, and only then did they look at the budget. They matched the brutal physics of electricity to the specific metal box hiding behind the wall.
It's an incredible invisible ballet.
Mm.
So, to wrap up our journey, panel boards are for your compact, downstream, wall-mounted branch distribution. Switchboards are your massive, economical, commercial service entrance gateways.
Right.
And switchgear is your compartmentalized, draw-out heavyweight for mission-critical environments where failure and downtime are simply not an option.
Before we finish, though, there's one final detail hidden in the physics that I think we have to consider.
Okay.
We've learned today that the equipment class is strictly dictated by the available fault current at the exact moment of installation. It's a snapshot in time, but buildings age.
Right.
Utilities constantly upgrade their grids, adding more capacity and much larger transformers to neighborhoods to handle modern demands.
Oh, wait. The size of the lake behind the dam gets bigger.
Exactly. So what happens when the physics of the grid change decades later? Does the perfectly safe switchboard carefully chosen by an engineer 30 years ago, based on a 1990s fault current study, suddenly lack the physical strength to hold back the modern grid?
Oh, wow.
Does it become a hidden liability sitting quietly behind that locked metal door today?
That is deeply unsettling, but it is definitely something to mull over the next time you plug in your laptop and just expect the power to flow. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden, highly regulated architecture of power distribution. Keep questioning what is behind the walls, stay curious, and we'll see you next time.